They were deliberately biding their time, drawing out the essentially formal and meaningless conversation because they were studying me at close hand. They were likely monitoring countless aspects of my physicality, of which I was totally unaware. They knew Amel was inside me. They knew that Amel and I were one. They knew that Amel was studying them, too, just as I was studying them, and as they were studying me. I think something dark and slightly ominous must have appeared in my expression or my demeanor, because all at once they seemed to react, to gather themselves up, to exchange infinitesimal signals, and to look to Tescammon for a decisive gesture or word. "You will excuse me now, won't you?" I said, striving to be gracious as I could. "There are others waiting for me. I'm leaving for home in a matter of nights to prepare a place for a wholly new..." I stopped. "A wholly new what?"
"A wholly new reign," said Magnus gently. There was the same loving smile on his lips. "A wholly new era will suffice," I said. "I'm not sure I want it to be called a reign."
He smiled at this, as though he found it not only impressive, but somehow endearing. I didn't know whether I was feeling love or hatred for him. Why, it certainly couldn't be hatred. I was too completely happy to be alive. I had the sense again that they were studying me in ways I couldn't fathom, searching my face and form for signs of what was within. Yet Amel was silent. Amel was not helping me with them. Amel was there, yes, but utterly quiet. Tescammon caught my hand. His was far colder than mine. It had the hard, icy texture of the children of the millennia, but his face was very warm, and he said,
"Forgive us for troubling you on this night, and so soon, but we were eager to see you with our own eyes, and we will go now, yes. I give you my apologies for our conduct. I think we are more impetuous, and perhaps more excited than you can know."
"I understand," I said. "Thank you, my friends." But I couldn't repress my suspicions as they took their leave now, moving in a small, loose body past me out of the drawing room into the hall and through the front door. Armand went with them, his arm around the dark-haired ghost, the ghost who had been weeping, and the door was closed. I realized that I was alone with Louis in the empty hallway. The others had gone.
"You know who they are?" I whispered. "I know what they told me," he said, walking along with me, "and I know what they told you, and the others obviously know who they are, and they're not afraid of them. Yet all wait for you to take command, you to come, you to greet them and invite them to your home in France. You are the leader, Lestat, no doubt about it. All know it. And these ghosts and spirits, or whoever they are, they know it too."
I stopped. I put my arm around him. I held him close to me. "I'm Lestat," I said in a low voice.
"You're Lestat. I'm the same Lestat you've always known, and no matter how I'm changed, I'm still that same being."
"I know," he said warmly. I kissed him. I pressed my lips to his, and I held this kiss for a long, silent moment, and then I gave in to a silent wave of feeling, and I took him in my arms. I held him tight against me. I felt his unmistakable silken skin, his soft, shining black hair. I heard the blood throbbing in him, and time dissolved, and it seemed I was in some old and secret place, some warm tropical grotto we'd once shared. Ours alone in some way, with the scent of sweet olive blossoms and the whisper of moist breeze.
"I love you," I whispered.
In a low, intimate voice he answered, "My heart is yours." I wanted to weep, but there was no time. At that moment Gregory and Seth reappeared with Severin, and Severin told me that they had seen to the ballroom and all was in readiness. Marius and Pandora were prepared. The candles had been lighted.
"I'm sorry about our unexpected guests," said Severin.
It seems a true prince is much in demand. But you go now to those waiting for you." Victor and Rose were in the French library. They had chosen a kind of muted finery for the ceremony. Rose wore a long-sleeved dress of soft, clinging black silk that left her throat bare and hung beautifully to her feet, and Victor wore a simple thobe of black wool. The severity of these garments made their shining complexions all the more vivid, their lips all the more naturally pink, and their eager eyes all the more heartbreakingly innocent as well as vibrant. I wanted to be with them, but I felt immediately that I was going to weep, that I couldn't prevent it, and I almost fled. But this really was not a choice available to me. I had to do what was right for them. I took them in my arms and asked if they were still resolved to come to us. Of course they were. "I know there's no turning back for either of you," I said, "and I know you both believe that you're prepared for the road you're taking. I know this, but you must know how much I grieve right now for what you might have been in the course of time, and what now you will never be." "But why, father?" asked Victor. "Yes, we're young, we know this, we don't challenge it. But we're already dying, as are all young things. Why can't you be completely happy for us?" "Dying?" I asked. "Well, yes, that's true. I don't say it's not true. But can I be blamed for wondering what you might have been in 10 more years of mortal life? Or 20 or 30. Is that dying, for a young man to grow into a man in his prime, for a beautiful young bud of a woman to become the full blossom? We want to be forever as we are now," said Rose. Her voice was so sweet, so tender. She didn't want this to be painful for me. She was comforting me. "Surely you of all people understand," she pressed. How could I? What was the point of reminding them that I'd never chosen the blood? I'd never had such a chance. And what was the point of sentimentalizing the fact that had I lived out my life as a mortal man, even my bones would be gone now, perished in the earth if I died in my bed at the age of 90? I was about to speak to them when I heard Amel inside me. He spoke in the softest whisper. "Keep to your vow," he said. "They are not dying. They are coming to you as a prince and princess to be part of your court. We are not death. No, we never have been, have we? We are immortal." His voice was so resonant, so subtle in tone that it shocked me. But this was, in fact, the same tone he'd used since he'd come into me. And yet it was the voice that I'd been hearing for decades. "Give them courage," he whispered. "But I leave you these moments. They are yours more truly than they are mine." Inwardly I thanked him. I looked at them, Victor to my left at eye level with me, and Rose gazing up, her face a perfect oval framed by her shining black hair. "I know," I said. "I do know. We can't ask you to wait. We shouldn't. We can't live either for the simple fact that some gruesome accident might take you away from us at any random moment. Once the blood's been offered, there is no waiting, no preparing, not really." Rose kissed me on the cheek. Victor stood patiently beside me, merely smiling. "All right, my babies," I said. "This is the grand moment." I couldn't prevent the tears. The clock would soon strike 9. High above in the ballroom, Marius and Pandora waited, and it would have been purely selfish of me to delay this further. The whole great house of Trinity Gate was scented with flowers. "It is the finest gift," I whispered, the tears tinting my vision. "It is the gift that we can give, which means life everlasting." They clung to me tightly. "Go now," I said. "They're waiting for you. Before the sun rises, you will be born to darkness, but you will see all light then as you've never before imagined it. As Marius once said, an endless illumination in which to understand all things. And when I set eyes on you again, I'll give you my blood as my blessing, and you will really be my children.
30. Cyril, the silence heard round the world. He was hungry again, and disappointed to be bothered by it so soon. He listened, and the great emptiness amazed him. He lay in his cave, in blessed solitude and darkness, and he thought, "They are all gone. Quiet the cities around him, quiet the land, only the cries and rumbling and human voices. Except for that radio voice, that blood drinker from America speaking through a computer or a cell phone somewhere out there in the wilderness of Tokyo. The voice is now one of us. The voice is the root of our tribe." What could that possibly mean? He slipped out into the warm night. Seems it was another one now speaking through the radio, and not one of those desperate young ones weeping to Benji Mahmood for solace or help. No, it was a calm voice, simply talking, talking about the quiet that had descended over our world. Before midnight, Cyril had visited the silence of Beijing and the silence of Hong Kong. Was it thirst that had awakened him, or was it curiosity? Something had happened, as remarkable as the waking of the Queen years ago, something as remarkable as the coming of the voice. They were gone, the others. On he moved to Mumbai, and then to Kolkata, and on towards the cities of the two rivers and the mighty Nile. Gone, all of them, everywhere, those miserable little monsters struggling for their rung on the ladder to eternal life. At last he stood in the ancient city of Alexandria, in the small hours near dawn, this modern metropolis he so loathed on account of the stones and blood buried beneath it, the old catacombs in which the wicked queen had been worshipped by the priesthood that had taken him out of life so long ago. Even here the voice of Benji Mahmood continued, but it was recorded now. "It is a new era. It is a new time. We are the people of darkness. We are the people of everlasting life. The prince has spoken. The prince rules." The prince? He couldn't fathom it. Who was the prince? He walked through a narrow street, listening for that recorded broadcast, until he came upon a small dark tavern filled with drunk, lazy mortals on whom he might easily feed. Skins of all nations here. That pulsing, twanging music he hated. And in the corner on a filthy little table against a wall, covered with a beaded curtain, stood the computer through which Benji Mahmood addressed the world. A pretty mortal girl, puffing on a long pink cigarette, listened to Benji Mahmood and laughed under her breath. She saw Cyril. "Come here, big boy. Just let me make you happy. Come on, closer, closer. Daggers in the back room." Her skin was thick with tinted powder, her eyes rimmed in coal. She had the red smile of a child witch. He sat down beside her in the shadows. The stench of the place was vile, but he wouldn't be here very long, and the smell of her blood was pure. All lies die in the blood. All evil is purged in the blood. "You know," she said to him in English, "he could make you want to be a real vampire." And she laughed again, a rich, cynical, ugly laugh, lifting her yellow drink and spilling it down the front of her dark dress.
"Never mind that," he said as he kissed her.
She pushed at him helplessly as he sank his teeth.
"Sold into it at 12 years old. Honey, tell me all about it."
And the blood sang and sang its ancient and unchanging song. He walked away from the city. He walked away from the damp, hazy air of the Mediterranean, inland, to the everlasting sands. He would sleep here in the land of Egypt, maybe for years. He would sleep in the land of his birth. Why not? Finally, he stood alone under the great, dark sky, away from all human sounds and scents, with the cold desert wind washing him, cleansing away the filth that clung to him of foreign lands. Then the voice sighed inside his head.
"Oh, spare me," Cyril cried.
Get away from me. Don't torment me here.
But the voice spoke to him now with an inflection he'd never heard before, and with a deep resonance that was wholly new. It was beautiful. And yet it was the voice, and the voice said,
Cyril, come home. Come home to the tribe. At last we are one.
XXXI. Rose, the people of the moon and stars. The voice of Pandora called to her from far away,
Rose, drink!
And she could hear Marius calling to her, and Victor, Victor's desperate plea, Rose, drink! The burning droplets hit her lips, trickled into her mouth. Poison! She couldn't move. Gardner had a hold of her and was whispering in her ear,
Would you disappoint me yet again, Rose? Rose, how dare you do this to me?
To me, to me, to me. The echo faded into the roaring voice of the minister's wife, Mrs. Hayes.
And if you cannot convict yourself of sin, deeply convict yourself and admit your sin and all the dreadful things you've done, and you know what you have done, you can never be saved.
Her grandmother was talking to them. She was in the little lawyer's office in Athens, Texas, but she was right there with Gardner.
Don't want the child, really. Don't know who the father was.
Gardner clung to her, his breath hot in her face, his fingers closing on her throat. How could that be true when her body was gone? She floated in this darkness, sinking ever deeper and deeper. The dark clouds rolled upwards, thick and swelling and blinding. Victor cried out, and Pandora and Marius called to her, but they were fading. Oh, she'd seen such wondrous things when Pandora held her. She'd seen the heavens, and she'd heard the music of the spheres. Never had anything been more grand. Gardner's fingers bit into her neck. Her heart jumped, and then slowed. It was so slow, the beat of her heart, and she was so weak, so dreadfully, impossibly weak. Dying. Surely she was dying.
Do you realize what this means, Rose, if you do this to me?
Gardner demanded.
You made a fool of me, Rose. You destroyed my life, my career, all my dreams, all my plans, ruined by you, Rose.
If we knew who the child's father was, said the old woman in her slow Texas voice,
but you see, we had no contact with our daughter, and really we just
don't want me, and why should you? And whoever did that wasn't paid to want me, paid to educate me, paid to take care of me, paid to love me, why isn't it over? Why am I sinking farther and farther down? Uncle Lestan came towards her, Uncle Lestan shining and striding towards her, in his red velvet jacket and his black boots, coming on, unstoppable, fearless, with his hands out.
"Rose!"
he cried. She screamed his name.
"Uncle Lestan, take me, please, don't let them... help me!"
Gardner choked the voice out of her. But Uncle Lestan loomed over her, his face shimmering in the light of the candles. All those candles, candles, and candles!
"Help me!"
she cried, and he bent to kiss her, and she felt those needles, those dreadful, sharp needles in her neck.
"Not enough blood!"
cried Marius.
"Just enough," said Uncle Lestan, "to let me in."
The blackness had weight and mass, and thickened around them. They were all talking at once, Gardner, Mrs. Hayes, and her grandmother.
"She's dying," said someone, and it was one of those girls at the school, the horrible school, but the other girls laughed and jeered. "She's faking, she's a liar, she's a slut."
Laughter, laughter rolling up into the blackness with Gardner chanting,
"You're mine, Rose, I forgive you for what you did to me, you're mine."
Uncle Lestan grabbed Gardner by the throat and dragged him away from her. Gardner snarled and screamed and fought. He bit into Uncle Lestan's hand, but Uncle Lestan tore Gardner's head from him, stretching his neck like a long, wrinkled, elastic stocking. She gasped, she screamed, and Gardner's head melted, mouth turning downwards, eyes bleeding downwards, black and fluid and ghastly, and his head flopped down at the end of the broken, wrinkled neck, and the body dropped into a sea of blood. Beautiful blood.
"Rose, drink from me," said Uncle Lestan. "I am the blood. I am the life."
"Don't you do that, child,"
screamed Mrs. Hayes. She reached for Uncle Lestan's golden hair, reached for him, for his shining face.
"Your blood!"
It filled her mouth. A great moan broke from her. She became the moan. She swallowed over and over again. The blood of heaven. Gardner's body floated in a stream of blood, dark, ruby-red and blackish blood, and the face of Mrs. Hayes expanded, grew immense, a gleaming white mask of wrath. Uncle Lestan snatched at it, tore it loose like a fragile veil, and her voice died as her face died, like a flag burning, and he sent it down into the dark, blackish blood current. Her grandmother, the old Texas woman, was sliding downwards with her hands out, paling, disappearing into the river of blood, too. Like Dante's river of blood, flowing on, bubbling, crimson, black, beautiful.
"And hell shall have no dominion," said Uncle Lestan.
"No, no dominion,"
she whispered. And they were rising upwards, rising the way they had from the Greek island that was breaking into pieces below them, pieces falling into the foaming blue sea.
"Blood, child, blood flower, blood rose," said Uncle Lestan.
She was safe in his arms. Her lips were open on his neck, and his blood was pumping through her body, pumping into her skin, her tingling, prickling skin. She saw his heart, his blood-red heart, throbbing and brightening, and the long, lovely tendrils of his blood surrounding her heart and enclosing it, and it seemed a great fire burned in his heart and her heart too, and when he spoke, another immense voice echoed his words.
"Finest flower of the savage garden," he said, "life everlasting."
She looked down. The rolling, smoking darkness was evaporating and disappearing. The dark river of blood was gone. The world sparkled beneath the mist with thousands and thousands of tiny lights, and above them was the firmament. All around them was the firmament, and the galaxies of song and story and the music of the spheres.
"My beloved Rose, you are with us now," said Uncle Lestan.
"With her now, with us," said the other voice, the echoing voice.
The words flowed into her on the blood that throbbed in her arms and legs, burned in her skin. Marius whispered into her ear that she was theirs now, and Pandora's lips touched her forehead, and Victor held her even as Uncle Lestan held her.
"My bride." "You've always been mine," Lestat said. "For this you were born, my brave Rose, and you are with us, and one of us. And we are the people of the moon and the stars."
32. Louis. It's our come at last. Trinity Gate was quiet tonight, except for Sibel and Antoine playing a duet in the drawing-room, and Benji upstairs talking confidently to his best friend, who just happened to be the whole world. Rosamandes and Benedict had gone to the opera with Alessandra. Armand and Daniel Molloy were out hunting alone in the gentle, warm rain. Flavius, Abacus, Zenobia, and Davis had gone home to Geneva, along with an eager, desperate blood-drinker named Killer, who had shown up at the door, in Old West garb of dungarees and a shaggy-sleeved buckskin jacket, begging to be allowed in. Friend of Davis, the beloved of Gregory, they'd welcomed him at once. Jesse and David were in the Amazon, at Maharit's old sanctuary, with Seth and Farid. Severine and her family had also gone home, and so had Notka and the musicians and singers from the Alps. Marius remained, working in the Tudor library, on the rules he would present to Lestat in time. Everard de Landen remained with him, poring over an old book of Elizabethan poetry, interrupting Marius softly now and then to ask the meaning of a phrase or a word. And Lestat was gone, gone with Gabrielle and with Rose and Victor,
and with Pandora, and Arjun, and Bianca Soldarini, and Flavius, and with Gregory and Chrysanthi, to his castle in the mountains of the Massif Central, to prepare for the first great reception of the new court to which they would all come. How fine and perfect Victor and Rose were! And how they loved each other still, and how they'd welcomed their new vision, their new powers, their new hopes. Ah, just brave fledglings. Only a little rain fell on this garden bench behind the townhouse. Tucked as it was beneath the largest of the oaks, the raindrops singing in the leaves overhead. Louis sat there, back to the trunk of the tree, a copy of his memoir, Interview with the Vampire, the memoir that had sparked the Vampire Chronicles, open on his lap. He wore his favourite old dark coat, a little threadbare but so comfortable, and his favourite old flannel trousers, and a fine white shirt Armand had forced upon him with buttons of pearl and outrageous lace. But Louis had never really minded lace. Unseasonably warm for September, but he liked it, liked the dampness in the air, liked the music of the rain, and loved the seamless and never-ending roar of the city, as much a part of it as the great river was a part of New Orleans, the innumerable population around him holding him safe, in this tiny walled place that was their garden, where the lilies opened their white throats and powdery yellow tongues to the rain. On the page, Louis read the words he'd spoken years ago to Daniel Molloy, when Daniel had been an eager and enchanted human, listening to Louis so desperately. And his tape recorder had seemed such an exotic novelty, the two together in that bare, dusty room on Divisadero Street in San Francisco, unnoticed by the undead world. I wanted love and goodness in this which is living death. It was impossible from the beginning, because you cannot have love and goodness when you do what you know to be evil, what you know to be wrong. With his whole being, Louis had believed those words, and they had shaped the blood drinker that he was then, and the blood drinker he remained after for many a year. And was that dark conviction not still inside him, under the veneer of the resigned and contented creature he appeared to be now? He didn't honestly know. He remembered completely how he had spoken then of chasing phantom goodness in its human form. He looked down at the page. No one could in any guise convince me of what I myself knew to be true, that I was damned in my own mind and soul. What had really changed? He'd learned once more somehow after Lestat had shattered the undead realm with his antics and his pronouncements, to live from night to night in a semblance of happiness, and to seek for grace once more in the music of operas, symphonies and choruses, and in the splendour of paintings old and new, and in the simple miracle of human vitality all around him, with Armand and Benji and Cybele at his side. He had learned his old theology was useless to him, and perhaps always had been. An incurable canker inside him rather than a spark to kindle any kind of hope or faith. But now a new vision had taken hold of him, a new witness to something he could no longer deny. His mind was no longer stubborn and locked against its vagrant possibilities and wild escalating light. What if the old sensibilities that had forged him had not been the sacrosanct revelation that he had once assumed? What if it were possible to invest every cell of his being with a gratitude and acceptance of self that could bring not mere contentment, but certain joy? It seemed impossible. Yet undeniably, he felt it happening. He felt some overall quickening that was so surprisingly new for him that no one save himself could or would understand. But no other understanding was needed. He knew this. For what he'd been, the being he'd been, required no confessions to those he knew and loved, but only that he loved them and affirmed their purpose with his transformed soul. And if he had once been the soul of an age, as Armand had long ago told him he was, well, so be it. Because he saw that dark and lustrous age with its decayed beliefs and doomed rebellions as only a beginning, a vast and fertile kindergarten in which the terms of his struggle had not been without value, but were now most certainly the phantoms of a past from which he had, in spite of himself, exorably emerged. He had not
perished. That might be his only significant accomplishment. He had survived. Yes, he'd been defeated more than once, but fortune had refused to release him, and he was here now, whole, and quietly accepting of the fact, though he honestly did not know why. But what loomed ahead of him now were challenges more wondrous and splendid than he'd ever foreseen. And he wanted this future, this time in which hell would have no dominion, and in which the devil's road had become the road of the people of darkness, who were essentially children no more. This was beyond happiness, and beyond contentment. This was nothing other than peace. From the depths of the townhouse came the music of Antoine and Sibel, with a new melody, a furious Tchaikovsky waltz. Ah, the waltz of the Sleeping Beauty. And on the music surged in Antoine's magnificent glissandos, and Sibel's pounding chords. Oh, how differently he heard this triumphal music now than he had once heard it, and how he opened himself to it, acknowledging its magnificent claims. He closed his eyes. Was he making lyrics for this swirling melody? Was he forming some affirmation for his soul? Yes, and I do want this. Yes, I do take it. Yes, I hold it in my heart. The will to know this beauty forever. The will to let it be the light on my path. On they went, faster and faster, the piano and the violin singing of gaiety and glory as if they had always been one. A random noise pierced his thoughts. Something wrong. Be en garde. The music had stopped. Over the top of the brick wall to his left, he saw a human crouched in the darkness, incapable of seeing him there as he saw the human. He heard the soft, stealthy sounds of Sibel and Antoine drawing near to the glass porch that ran along the back of the three townhouses. He heard the mortal intruder's labored breath. The intruder, dressed in black garments and black skull cap, dropped down into the wet grass. With deft feline movements he darted out from the shrubbery and into the dim yellow light from the house. Scent of fear, scent of rage, scent of blood. He saw Louis now, the lone figure on the bench beneath the tree, and he stiffened. Out of his slick, black windbreaker jacket he raised a knife that shone like silver in the semi-darkness. Slowly he came towards Louis. Ah, the old menacing dance. Louis closed the book, but he didn't put it aside. The scent of the blood made him faintly delirious. He watched this emaciated yet powerful young man come closer. He saw the malignant face infinitely more clearly than the man, hardened with purpose, could see his. The man was sweating and breathing raggedly, crazed with drugs and seeking for anything he might snatch to find the anodyne for his twisting gut. Such beautiful eyes! Such black eyes! Why these walls and not some other garden meant nothing in the scheme of things to this one. And before Louis could utter a word to him, the man had resolved to sink the knife into Louis's heart. Death, Louis said now loudly enough to stop the man, though he was only a few feet away. Are you ready for this? Is this what you truly want? A sinister laugh came from the intruder. He stepped forward, crunching the lilies, the stout, white calla lilies underfoot. "Yeah, death, my friend," the man said. "You're in the wrong place at the wrong time." "Ah, but for your sake," Louis sighed, "would that were true. But it has never been less true than it is now." He had the man in his grip. The knife was gone, lost in the wet leaves. Sibel and Antoine waited in the shadows behind the wall of glass. The man fought and kicked in a small, useless fury. Oh, how Louis had always cherished the struggle, young muscles straining against him, and the inevitable strangled curses like so much unwitting applause. He drove his fangs right into the arterial stream. How ever translate for a mortal world the heat and purity of this simple feast, salt and blood and dark, shiny, brittle fantasies of victories, all flowing into him and out of the victim with the last protest of his dying heart? It was finished. The man lay dead among the lilies. Louis stood wondrously satisfied and reanimated, the night opening up above him through luminous clouds, and the music inside the house began again. Flushed with blood,
Flushed with the old deceptive but seductive sense of illimitable power, he thought of Lestat across the sea. What charms would his great castle hold? And what manner of court would convene there in chambers of stone that Louis so longed to see? He had to smile when he thought of the easy swagger with which Lestat had fulfilled the tribe's collective dreams. And the road ahead could not be smooth, and simplicity could never be the goal. The burden of conscience was part of Louis's human heart, and the heart of every blood drinker he had ever known, even Armand. And the struggle for goodness, actual goodness, would and must obsess them all. That was the miracle which now united the tribe. How wondrous it suddenly seemed that such a struggle could now lay waste with such undeniable power the old dead dualities which had enslaved him for so long. But he looked down at the man who lay dead at his feet, and a terrible sorrow took hold of him. Death is the mother of beauty. It was a line from a poem by Wallace Stevens, and it came to him now with a painful irony. Beauty for me, perhaps, but not beauty for this one whom I have destroyed. He knew terror for a moment, terror that might never really leave him, no matter how much he came to understand or to learn. Terror. Terror that this tender young mortal might have lost his soul to utter meaninglessness and annihilation, and that all of them, his blood-drinker brothers and sisters, no matter how powerful, how old, how grand, might some day fall victim to the same brutal end. After all, what ghost or spirit, no matter how eloquent or skilled, could claim that anything of sentience lay beyond the thick, mysterious air surrounding this planet? Again he thought of Stevens's poem. Shall our blood fail, or shall it come to be the blood of paradise, and shall the earth seem all of paradise that we shall know? His heart was breaking for the young man who lay there dead, eyes closed in the final sleep. The remains were already slowly perishing in the warm rain. His heart broke for all the victims everywhere of bloodlust and war and accident and old age and illness and unendurable pain. But his heart broke a little for once, for himself, too. And that, perhaps, was the real change in him, the change that he welcomed, that he could see himself as part now of all this great and glistening world. He was not part of some mindless force that sought to destroy it. No, he was part of it. He was part of this night, with its sweet, mild rain, and this whispering garden with its fragrant flowers and its trees, and the breezes that moved their branches. And he was part of the roar of the city rising around him, and part of the sharp, shining music that came from within the house. He was part of the grass beneath his feet, and the tiny, relentless hordes of winged things that sought to devour the human waiting there helplessly for a proper grave. He thought of Lestat again, confident, smiling, wearing the mantle of power as easily as he had always worn his finery, old and new. He said under his breath, "Beloved Maker, beloved Prince, I will be with you soon." Tuesday, November 26, 2013, Palm Desert. Appendix 1. Characters and their chronology. Arno, a spirit manifesting to humans 6,000 years ago, or in 4,000 BC. Akasha, the first vampire, made by a fusion with a spirit Amo 6,000 years ago, or in 4,000 BC, thereafter known as the Mother, or the Sacred Fount, or the Queen. Enkil, the husband of Akasha, and the first vampire made almost immediately by her. Kaman, the second vampire made by Akasha within the first years after the fusion. Maharet and Makari, twin witches born 6,000 years ago. Makari was made a vampire by Kaman. Maharet was made by Makari. Kaman, Maharet, and Makari became the first brood rebelling against Akasha, and making other blood drinkers when and where they chose. Nebamun, later Gregory Duff Collingsworth,
made by Akashi in the first few years to lead her queen's blood troops against the first brood. Seth, the human son of Akasha, brought into the blood perhaps 15 to 20 years after the fusion. Sevrain, a Nordic woman brought into the blood illegally by Nebamun Gregory, about 5,000 years ago, or 1,000 years after the blood genesis, the maker of several vampires yet unnamed. Rochamandes, a male from Crete, brought into the blood at the same time as Sevrain to serve in the queen's blood, made directly by Akasha. Avicus, Cyril, Tescamen, Egyptian blood drinkers made by the priests of Akasha's cult well before the common era, drinking the mother's blood, but not made by her. Marius, a Roman patrician, kidnapped by the Druids and brought into the blood shortly after the birth of Christ, or at the dawn of the common era, made by Tescamen, who was shortly thereafter presumed dead. Pandora, a Roman patrician woman named Lydia, brought into the blood by Marius in the first century. Flavius, a Greek slave brought into the blood by Pandora during the first century. Male, a Druid priest, the kidnapper of Marius, brought into the blood by Avicus and presumed dead. Hesketh, a Germanic, cunning woman brought into the blood by Tescamen in the first century, murdered in the 8th century. Chrysanthe, a merchant's wife from the Christian city of Hira, brought into the blood by Nebamun, newly risen and named Gregory, in the 4th century. Zenobia, a Byzantine woman brought into the blood by Eudoxia, now dead, who was made by Cyril around the 6th or 7th century. Alessandra, a Merovingian princess, daughter of King Dagobert I, brought into the blood in the 7th century by Rochamandes. Gremt Stryker Knowles, a spirit who enters the narrative in the 8th century, 748. Benedict, a Christian monk of the 8th century, brought into the blood by Rochamandes around the year AD 800. Thorn, a Viking, brought into the blood by Maharit around the 9th century of the Common Era. Notke the Wise, a monk and a musician and a composer, brought into the blood by Benedict around AD 880, maker of many musician vampires, as yet unnamed. Eleni and Eugenie de Landen, fledglings of Rochamandes made in the early Middle Ages. Everard de Landen, a fledgling of Rochamandes made in the Middle Ages. Arjun, a prince of the Kola dynasty in India, brought into the blood by Pandora around 1300. Santino, Italian vampire made during the time of the Black Death, long-time Roman coven master of the Children of Satan, presumed dead. Magnus, an elderly alchemist who stole the blood from Benedict during the 1400s, the maker of Lestat in 1780. Armand, a Russian icon painter kidnapped in the vicinity of Kiev and brought to Venice as a slave and made into a vampire by Marius around 1498. Bianca Soldarini, a Venetian courtesan made in the blood by Marius around 1498. Raymond Galant, a faithful mortal scholar of the Talamasca, presumed dead in the 16th century. Lestat de Liancourt, 7th son of a French marquis, made a vampire in the year 1780 by Magnus, author of the 2nd book in the Vampire Chronicles, The Vampire Lestat. Gabrielle de Liancourt, Lestat's mother, made by him in the blood in 1780. Nicolas de L'Enfant, close friend of Lestat, made into a vampire by Lestat in 1780, and long dead. Louis de Pointe-du-Lac, a Louisiana-French colonial plantation owner, brought into the blood by Lestat in 1791. Louis began the books, known as the Vampire Chronicles, with Interview with the Vampire in 1976. Claudia, an orphan brought into the blood around 1794, long dead. Antoine, a French musician exiled to Louisiana and brought into the blood by Lestat around 1860. Daniel Malloy, an American male of about 20, who enters the narrative when he interviews Louis de Pointe-du-Lac about his life as a vampire, resulting in the publication of Interview with the Vampire in 1976. He is brought into the blood by Armand in 1985, some 9 years later. Jesse Reeves, mortal descendant of Maharet, brought into the blood by Maharet in 1985. David Talbot, superior general of the Talamasca, brought into the blood in 1992 by Lestat. David, the victim of a body switch, lost his original biological body, that of an elderly man, before being made into a vampire in the body of a much younger man. Killer, an American male vampire of unknown origin, founder of the Fang Gang, who entered the narrative about 1985. Davis, a black dancer from New York, a member of the Fang Gang, brought into the blood by Killer sometime before 1985. Farid Bansali, a brilliant Anglo-Indian doctor and surgeon, brought into the blood by Seth around 1986 in Mumbai. Benjamin Benji Mahmoud, a 12-year-old Palestinian Bedouin boy, brought into the blood by Marius in 1997. Sibel, a young American pianist, about 20, brought into the blood by Marius in 1997. Rose, an American girl of around 20, rescued as a small child by Lestat from an earthquake in the Mediterranean around 1995, his ward. Dr. Flannery Gilman, an American doctor and discredited vampire researcher, brought into the blood by Farid in the early 21st century. Victor, a human experiment conducted under the auspices of Farid Bansali and his maker Seth, along with Dr. Flannery Gilman, before her induction into the blood. Assorted unnamed fledglings, ghosts, and spirits. Appendix 2. An Informal Guide to the Vampire Chronicles. 1. Interview with the Vampire, 1976. In this, the first published memoir of a vampire within his tribe, Louis de Pointe-du-Lac tells his life story to a reporter he encounters in San Francisco, Daniel Malloy. Born in the 18th century in Louisiana, Louis, a rich plantation owner, encounters the mysterious Lestat de Liancourt, who offers him immortality through the blood, and Louis accepts, beginning a long spiritual search for the meaning of who and what he has become. The child vampire Claudia and the mysterious Armand of the Théâtre des Vampires are central to the story. 2. The Vampire Lestat, 1985. Here, Lestat de Liancourt offers his full autobiography, recounting his life in 18th-century France as a penniless provincial aristocrat, a Parisian stage actor, and finally as a vampire in conflict with other members of the undead, including the coven of the Children of Satan. After a long physical and spiritual journey, Lestat reveals ancient secrets about the vampire tribe that he has kept for more than a century, emerging as a rock star and rock video maker, eager to start a war with humankind that might bring the undead together and end in vampiric annihilation. 3. The Queen of the Damned, 1988. Though written by Lestat, this story includes multiple points of view from mortals and immortals all over the planet, responding to Lestat's revealing rock music and videos, which awakened the 6,000-year-old queen of the vampires, Akasha, from her long slumber. The first book to deal with the entire tribe of the undead around the world. This novel contains the first inclusion of the mysterious secret order of mortal scholars known as the Talamasca, who study the paranormal. 4. The Tale of the Body Thief, 1992. Lestat's memoir, in which he recounts his disastrous encounter with a clever and sinister mortal named Raglan James, a sorcerer experienced in switching bodies, a battle which forces Lestat into closer involvement with his friend David Talbot, superior general of the Talamasca, whose scholarly members are dedicated to the study of the paranormal. 5. Memnock the Devil, 1995. Lestat narrates a personal adventure, this time filled with devastating shocks and mysteries, as he confronts a powerful spirit, Memnock, claiming to be none other than the devil of Christian lore, the fallen angel himself, who invites Lestat to journey with him to heaven and hell, and seeks to enlist Lestat as a helper in the Christian realm. 6. Pandora, 1998. Published under the series title
new tales of the vampires, this story is Pandora's autobiographical confession, recounting her life in the ancient Roman Empire during the time of Augustus and Tiberius, including her great and tragic love affair with the vampire Marius. And though it does recount later events, the book is principally focused on Pandora's first century as a vampire. 7. The Vampire Armand, 1998. Here Armand, a profound and enigmatic presence in earlier novels, offers his autobiography to the reader, explaining his long life since the time of the Renaissance, when he was kidnapped from Kiev and brought to Venice as a boy brothel slave, only to be rescued by the powerful and ancient vampire Marius. Yet another kidnapping puts Armand in the hands of the cruel and notorious children of Satan, superstitious vampires who worship the devil. Though Armand concludes his story in the present time, and introduces new characters to the chronicles, most of the account focuses on his earlier years. 8. Vittorio the Vampire, 1999. One of the new tales of the vampires, this is the autobiography of Vittorio of Tuscany, who becomes a member of the undead during the Renaissance. This character does not appear elsewhere in the vampire chronicles, but he is of the same tribe and does share the same cosmology. 9. Merrick, 2000. Told by David Talbot, this story is centered on Merrick, a Creole woman of color from an old New Orleans family and a member of the Talamasca, who seeks to become a vampire during the last years of the 20th century. This is a hybrid novel, involving a glimpse of a few characters from another series of books devoted to the history of the Mayfair Witches of New Orleans, to whom Merrick is related, but it principally focuses on Merrick's involvement with the undead, including Louis de Pont du Lac. 10. Blood and Gold, 2001. Another in the series of vampire memoirs, this time written by the ancient Roman Marius, explaining much about his 2,000 years amongst the undead and the challenges he faced in protecting the mystery of those who must be kept, the ancient parents of the tribe, Akasha and Enko. Marius offers his side of the story of his love affair with Armand, and his conflicts with other vampires. This novel concludes in the present, but is principally focused on the past. 11. Blackwood Farm, 2002. A hybrid novel narrated by Quinn Blackwood, recounting his personal history and involvement with the Talamasca, the undead, and the Mayfair Witches of New Orleans, who figure in another book series, set in a brief period of time in the early 21st century. 12. Blood Canticle, 2003. A hybrid novel narrated by Lestat, recounting his adventures with Quinn Blackwood and with the Mayfair Witches from another series of books. This story focuses on a brief period of time in the 21st century. 13. Prince Lestat, 2014. The return of Lestat, after years of silence. Many voices and points of view reveal the crises of the worldwide tribe of the undead. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Prince Lestat, The Vampire Chronicles, by Anne Rice. Executive Producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2014 by Anne O'Brien Rice. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.